On Sunday, June 10th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents trumpeter and composer Adam O'Farrill. Join us as we discuss Adam's musical lineage, working with a sibling, and what motivates his musical exploration. That's Sunday, June 10th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
I'm Cynthia Nixon. I'm running for governor of New York State, and I love WBAI. My dad and I used to listen together every weekend, and I'm a lifelong WBAI listener.
Is this where you wait for the bus to Luxembourg?
Yes, I'm taking the bus to Luxembourg.
Well, I'm not going to stay in Luxembourg.
Me either. I'm taking the train to Paris.
Well, me too. Are you going to stay in Paris?
No, I'm flying on to New York.
Well, I'm flying on to New York.
Brooklyn, really?
I'm going to Brooklyn.
What for?
To see John McDonough's Off the Meter at the Brooklyn Common.
Tales of a New York City cab driver.
Saturday night, June 23rd.
Me too.
Oh, really?
The great Malachi McCord is a special guest star.
I know. I can't wait.
Show starts at 7. Tickets are available at WBAI.org.
I got my tickets.
Me too. Off the Meter is a benefit performance for WBAI.
I know. I don't want to miss it.
You won't, but first...
But first what?
Don't miss the bus.
If you miss the bus to John McDonough's Off the Meter, take a taxi.
Hello, listeners. I'm WBI's General Manager, Bertol Reimers. I'm happy to announce that we have successfully moved out of the Empire State Building and are now transmitting from 4 Times Square. This is a major accomplishment and a turning point in our history, with a savings to WBI of $50,000 per month. With your help, we have preserved this precious media, but the task has just begun. We are now engaged in a campaign to liquidate the loan that allowed us to move forward. I encourage you to become a BAI buddy, a sustaining member to help WBI bring in a steady, predictable income. We want to reduce and eventually eliminate on-air fund drives. Please go to WBAI.org and become a member, and stay tuned for exciting new programming launching on WBAI in the very near future. Thank you.
The Community Advisory Board will be meeting on Sunday, June 10th at 1 p.m. at the 60 Wall Street Atrium. All listeners are welcome to attend. Once again, the Community Advisory Board will be meeting on Sunday, June 10th at 1 p.m. at the 60 Wall Street Atrium. All listeners are welcome to attend.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, two pieces that are both delightful and not so delightful. One is a reading by Thomas M. Dish, and the other by Gardner Dozois. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I just spent a few minutes searching for interviews with Ari Aster, the writer-director who's making his feature film debut with Hereditary. This is something I don't usually do for a review. I'm of the opinion that whatever you feel about a film should be influenced by the film only. But I came out of this with conflicting feelings, most of them centered around doubts about whether Mr. Aster is... And I mean this in the least snarky way possible, for real. I'll explain what I mean by that in a sec. There's no doubt that Hereditary is an impressive, gripping work. It's also a pretty unsparing work, starting off dark with a family. Annie, an artist who specializes in exquisitely detailed miniatures, played by Toni Collette. Steve, the patriarch. That's pretty much his defining feature, played by Gabriel Byrne. Peter, a sullen teen, played by Alex Wolff. And Charlie, a young girl with some very odd, hell-disturbing habits, played by Millie Shapiro, attending the funeral of Annie's especially problematic mother. The film then spirals down the rabbit hole with an especially disturbing event. I can't say what, its impact depends on it coming unexpectedly, that tests the bonds of the family and raises questions about some secrets held by Annie's mother and what that woman wanted from her daughter and her grandkids. And let me just say that if you've ever held the desire to see Toni Collette pass through multiple rings of hell, Hereditary is your movie. Once that gut-wrenching event occurs about a half hour in, she's pretty much a non-stop kaleidoscope of anguish, from inconsolable grief to vitriolic anger to wild-eyed mania. The movie puts the actress through so many ringers that there's a point where it begins to feel a little sadistic. Lars von Trier could watch this film and go, "Geez, dude, back off." But it has to be said that as unsparing as Hereditary is, it is a compelling exercise. Aster knows how to insert the needle and when to twist. What kept pulling me back is the film's supernatural turn, which is predicated on an interesting concept. Again, I can't elaborate, but is invoked with such hoary elements as automatic writing and stock seance ceremonies. And despite the visual evidence that supernatural forces are at work, just the fact that the strange events occur within the cliché of people assembled around a table, touching hands, adds a distance that interferes with me buying into things. I actually became more sympathetic with Annie's family, who, when Annie hysterically tries to coax them into helping her conjure the dead, regard her as the unhinged person she really does appear to be. And this is where I began my frantic search for some confirmation of where Astor is coming from, because the hoarier elements of heredity could just be laziness, or it could be that their very presence is meant to be regarded as some kind of commentary. There's evidence that Astor isn't completely presenting his scenario as some kind of objective reality. The film is full of surreal little elements. There's a bizarre moment when Annie, maker of miniatures, labors over a miniature gallery filled with miniature versions of her miniature works. And there's the way Charlie has a penchant for building miniature effigies out of discarded garbage, and the occasional bird head, a practice which is requoted later in the film on a plus-sized scale. So in doing my searches, I came upon this quote from Astor, talking about how he envisions his career. "I'm hoping that these films are nuanced enough, that they serve as serious cinema in a way that doesn't present me as a horror filmmaker." Okay, fair enough, nobody wants to be pigeonholed. But note the distancing of horror from quote-unquote serious cinema. This may be an important distinction within the industry. This quote is from an interview on IndieWire, so Astor may well have been speaking the language. I still bristle at the suggestion, maybe unintentional, that a horror film cannot be serious cinema as well. But it does make it interesting that a film whose supernatural elements have some provocative ideas behind them chooses to express those ideas with off-the-shelf ghost story trappings. And I kind of feel that my distance isn't completely wrong. Maybe the director was holding his own work at arm's length as well, which makes my feelings about Hereditary especially mixed. It is a supremely grueling exercise. This ain't Stephen King's It or even Get Out. It is well-mounted, beautifully envisioned, and intensely felt. It stumbles with Astor's odd attitude towards its supernatural elements, but it is quite a singular experience, and I'll take that any day. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
Thank you, Dan. It's a provocative review. I find it curious. We know that whether he's going to, the Astor, whether he's going to allow himself to be pigeonholed or not, it's not a movie that I'm going to be seeing. Because whether he is a horror film director or not, stuff that turns your stomach, that is intended to turn your stomach and leave eye worms, you know what an earworm is, right? It's when you have a tune in your head and you just cannot get that tune out of your head for whatever reason. There was a fun article about earworms not long ago in Quartz, which is one of my preferred online news services, and they had a very good piece about earworms. So what would that be, eye worms, when, you know, you just cannot unsee something as a result of what it is? So hopefully somebody will come up with something and let me know what they think. But eyeworm is what I'm going to use for a little while. I'm not doing a Facebook Live this morning. I don't have a guest, and it's fun to watch a guest. Or if I were doing mostly a reading aloud, and I'm going to do a short one, under 5 minutes long, then that might be a good reason to do a Facebook Live so that you can watch and enjoy what is going on. But it does distract me. It is an issue. Last week, in fact, there's more than one issue at hand. One issue is that if the WBAI router is not working, we're talking about the Wi-Fi router, and I have yet to see it work really well for a full 2 hour period. What happens is, A, it interrupts the actual stream so that people watching don't get to see it. This happened near the end of the show last week. Number two, if it throws me off the Wi-Fi and starts using mobile data, well, mobile data is limited. And 2 hours of video broadcasting, forget watching, just watching something from Netflix or something like that, but broadcasting something takes up about 2 gigabytes, about a gigabyte an hour, okay? P.S. properly, the word is gigabyte, but I had to give up that battle a long, long time ago. So, so I will decide from week to week when I will be doing a video add-on to the program or not. So, let's see. I'm copying files as I speak, and I have had so many technical issues this week already. I was finishing the Lightspeed podcast. I do the post-production on it, and I'm also the host, and this is something that will premiere in about, 5 or 6 hours. It's technically a Thursday podcast, but Thursday emanating out of California. And I had, things that have been working fine broke down. And last night, we're going to be talking about last night at length for a bit. At the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, the question is, what went right? Well, the show went right. Henry Wessels assembled a fabulous crew of people talking about science fiction writer Thomas M. Dish. Now, Tom Dish was a very early guest on this program from when Margot started the show, and she knew Dish, and he was probably on with her 3 times or so, once on a Monday morning when Margot had differing co-hosts, often alone, but occasionally with Neil Conan from the Public Affairs Department. And Neil had worked with our drama and literature director, Baird Searles, on a show called Of Unicorns and Universes. Later on, he basically went on to run National Public Radio, but, we all have to slum somewhere. And he's done quite a good job there. He's fairly well retired at this point, although I think that he's doing, is he still doing, is it Talk of the Town? Whatever. He's great on the radio. And then I was the Thursday and Friday co-host. I engineered almost 5 days a week, but Thursdays and Fridays were the Thursday or the Friday morning science fiction extravaganza, and that was my time to co-host with Margot. And eventually I would do readings, I would do various things on there. And then after about 1.5 years, when Adler went off to the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop, I took over the show. The show was canceled/moved. Canceled first and then moved, thanks to a load of letters from listeners that convinced the then management to bring me back. And that happened with a little help and aid from Robert Knight, the late Robert Knight. And through many of these years, through many of these times, Tom Dish was a guest on this show. Now, I'm also at this point the curator, and in early days, the recordist, an archivist of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And Tom was a regular there. He often read with Chip Delaney, Samuel R. Delaney. And they were very close friends. Chip wrote a major portion in his book, a major chapter in his book, The American Shore, all about Tom Dish. And again, makes for good reading. And then I had a relatively negative experience with Tom. And that was that one morning, remember the show was on from 5 to 7 a.m. Now, 5 a.m. is a lot harder to come in than it is at 1 a.m. Although at 1 a.m. we have a pretty decent audience, but it starts, you know, peeling off at about, so, 1:45, and by 3, there are crickets, you know. So thank God for the internet and for people listening, you know, people listening from around the world and things like that. So I'm not unsatisfied with the time slot. I just wish I had 3 hours instead of 2. The perfect radio show for freeform radio is 3 hours, the perfect time slot. But anyway, one morning, Tom was the guest, and he didn't show up. And I was concerned. Things can happen to people at 5 a.m. And I was going to talk about, you know, the glories of 5 to 7 a.m. Starting at 6 a.m., you're in primetime radio. People are getting out of bed as of 5:30. By 6, many of them are in their cars, whatever. It's drive time. If you check out a commercial station and ask them what their rates are for a commercial at 6 a.m., you'll find out it costs about the same as a commercial at 4 or 5 p.m. 5 p.m. is most certainly prime time. So that was a pretty cool time slot, but getting there was, like, not fun for the guests. I was, of course, used to it by then, but, you know, the guests, well, they had to be considered. And so I was concerned that something happened to Tom, and I call him up at home, you know, like noon the next day. And it's like, hey, Tom, are you okay? Was there a problem? I was expecting to see you. And he said, oh, no, it's like, you know, I was thinking about it the night before and thought, really? 5 a.m.? Screw it. He didn't say screw it. But we're going with that for right now. And I was saying, well, you know, you've been on the guest so many times. He'd been on at least 6 times. Excuse me, a dozen times. What happened? He said, it's not worth the bother. You're not worth the bother, Rich. That really, you know, cut a little. And so I didn't talk to Tom for 20 years. Then after I'd taken over the New York Review Science Fiction Readings as the curator, Henry Wessels, an antiquarian bookseller and all-around scholar in science fiction and big fan of writers who aren't as well known as they should be, like Avram Davidson and Tom Dish and so forth, came up with the idea of let's do the occasional tribute to different writers. I've done 3 or 4 of these so far. So we did one for Avram Davidson. And in the list I see, oh look, Henry has invited Tom Dish, and I had mixed feelings about that. But, you know, it was a long time, maybe 15 years at that point, and bygones be bygones and all that. Maybe Tom would be good, and Tom was wonderful. He was really good, and I asked him, so, do you want to do another reading? It's been years. And he said, oh yeah, absolutely. Let's do it. So I engaged him in 2008, June 3rd of 2008, to be a reader. He had a new novel just coming out at that point called The Word of God, which is in print from Tachyon Publications, published by Jacob Weissman. And It was wonderful. His co-reader was Karen Russell, who at the time was starting to make a name for herself for her short stories in The New Yorker, and at this point I think has been like a Pulitzer runner-up for nonfiction, and she's an amazing person no matter what. And I said, oh, you're going to be reading with Tom Dish. Oh, who's that? I said, oh, he wrote a book called 334, Camp Concentration, On Wings of Song. He's written some horror, like The Businessman or The Priest. He's a genius. He's a poet. He's very acerbic, very satirical. Oh, and he's written some juvenilia. Like he wrote a juvenile called The Brave Little Toaster. And when I said that, she said, oh my God, The Brave Little Toaster is like my favorite book. I grew up to that. And they made a movie. Yeah, yeah, they made a movie. Directed by some guy named John Lasseter, who was basically fired from Disney for making that movie. They just did not get along. Same way Tim Burton did not get along at Disney. Well, John Lasseter, if they can get over his noted behavior of hugging people inappropriately and things like that, I should say allegedly hugging people inappropriately, John Lasseter has been running a company called Pixar since before Disney acquired it. He not only came back to Disney, he's in charge of all Disney animated entertainment. And I believe that his six-month sabbatical to think things over, for both them and him to think things over, is about up. So we'll see if he comes back. At any rate, so he made The Brave Little Toaster, and Karen was delighted. She read a wonderful short story, which I've broadcast a few times. But we are going to hear in a little while the short story that Tom read. Not short story, the piece from The Word of God. And Tom sat on a table. He had sciatica. He was getting heavy. He needed physical support. And so so he sat on a table. We are at the South Street Seaport. Pardon me. There's another reason not to do a Facebook Live. When I have a sneezing fit on the air, I can just turn down my mic. If it's on Facebook, well, gives a whole new meaning to Facebook. Anyway, Tom's role in this book, The Word of God, is that he was God. And there's a point at which the gates of hell open up. And coming forth from the gates of hell to do battle with God, a.k.a. Thomas M. Dish, comes Philip K. Dick. It's a wonderful book. I really recommend it. Most of his books are wonderful. I, personally, am more of a fan of his short stories. But, you know, different people prefer different things. So, getting on with the story, I figured, okay, we're good now. Tom's a friend again. He performed, you know, through Henry Wessels brilliantly for me once. And he would do it. And so, let's do a radio show. I knew that his back was bad. So rather than force him into the 5 a.m. thing, remembering the incident that had happened some time back, I said, listen, I'll come to your place. His apartment was very well known. And we'll record there. And he said, sure thing. Be very happy to do it. But one thing. Now, this is on June 3rd. And he said, the holiday is coming up. And Tom always had a thing for the 4th of July. I knew Tom at WBAI through Baird Searles, who was doing various things with Delaney and Tom Dish and Joanna Russ and Theodore Sturgeon. It was quite a heady thing to be around these people when I was young. And so I always knew about his passion for the 4th of July. So it's like, okay, fine. He'll have his party, he'll have his plans, whatever. And I said, then when should I get back in touch with you? He said, oh, right after. Call me on the 5th or the 6th of July. We'll get together. On the 4th of July of the year 2008, Tom put a gun in his mouth and pulled the trigger. And when I had asked him, when we had made the arrangement, he told me to call him. He knew darn well that he was going to be dead on that date. Tom Dish is an amazing personality. We had a tribute to him, put together by Henry Wessels, last night at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And while we had technical difficulties, I was talking about those all the way through, it's still worth watching. You can go to live stream. Actually, you can go to my page on Facebook, my timeline, or to the New York Review of Science Fiction timeline, or actually to Samuel R. Delaney's page, just actually Samuel Delaney on Facebook. And you will see, linked from one place to another, a link to the video. And as I said, there will be problems, but for the most part, you will get the good stuff. But at the beginning, okay, before I go there, let's jump forward in time. We're going to hear two things this morning. We're going to hear Tom Dish's reading from July 3rd of 2008, from the Word of God, and then we're going to hear a reading from last October by Gardner Dozois. Gardner died last week, weekend before last, and he was an amazing person, so if people are tuning in for that, I just need to say now, yes, we're going to be getting to that. Tom's reading is about half an hour. Gardner's is listed at about 5:00 minutes, but I suspect that may include things we don't need to broadcast, like the raffle beforehand and stuff. Gardner's reading is not yet edited. Tom's is. So we're going to start out with Tom's. But last night, I did warn people that we might have a commercial. I'm going to warn you about that again tonight. We're near the end of this fundraising drive, and we may end up having to do commercials or something. We'd lose our license, but just think of what would happen if a company like Exo Export Monopolies would take over. Frank Heller did a beautiful radio drama version of the Thomas M. Dish short story, Fun with Your New Head. I don't have that. Hopefully Frank is listening, or I can send him an email, and he can send that to me. I would love it. But failing that, I will simply read the story. Fun with Your New Head. Heads are so funny, and there are 1,000 laughs in store for you in the new improved head. Everyone enjoys a talking head from young to old. Taste, see, smell, and pain with a head. Experience every emotion known to the head. And if you already have a head, remember what the heads say. Two heads are better than one. Enjoy a talking head. Every minute is different from the next in the incredible thought chaos of a head, and every head is different. Heads are so funny. Listen to the limbless talking head talk about freedom, death, beauty, and Godfather. Make the head fall in love with you. Any head can be made to love if training manual instructions are carefully observed. Watch the worn-out head die talking till the moment it decays. Indeed, it is not an exaggeration to say heads are so funny. Taste, see, smell, and pain with a head. Every head purchaser receives absolutely free a lifetime supply of food. Put food in the head's mouth, then insert consensual apparatus into left collarbone. You will taste every molecule of the mouth's food. Only those who have eaten with a mouth can understand the incredible sensations of food. Left collarbone is likewise input-output source for right eye and left eye. See the strange little world of the right eye looking at you. See the left eye, too. Then see through both the right eye and the left eye together. Every XO export head has two eyes. Don't accept less. Left collarbone is likewise input-output source for nose. Now, with the new improved head, you can experience the disconcerting primeval world of sex as the center of the new head's sex-tropic response is removed from obsolete and unsightly sacral area and redirected to the graceful nose. Just one more reason why two heads are better than one. Left collarbone is likewise input-output source for pain-sensitive chin. Throughout the galaxies, there are creatures, often the most insignificant, that can experience the famous negative pleasure. And now with the head, you can too. The new improved head is 30% more sensitive to pain, thanks to refinements in the chin. Left collarbone is likewise input-output source and control center for Adam's apple. Nothing is easier than to take over your head's talking function. Amuse your friends by talking through your own head. What could be funnier than talking to another head that thinks you are just a head, too? Everyone enjoys a talking head from young to old. Even more fun than the talking function of the head is thought function. Insert compassional apparatus into right collarbone and experience every emotion known to the head. You will feel the head's amazing love. You will be paralyzed with the head's consuming fear of pain and of its own inescapable death. You will hate your own self, perhaps the most exciting sensation of all. Heads are educational. Everyone should have his own head to grow up with. Heads provide an easy and stimulating introduction to basic concepts of Xeno language and Xeno culture. Each head is given a thorough grounding in the astonishing cultural traditions of its autochthonous planet. A third of a lifetime is devoted to the education of every XO export head. Heads are perfectly safe for the young. The sharp skeletal teeth are extracted from each head's mouth at the time of assembly and refitted with harmless hydraulic pseudo-teeth. Many designers consider heads to be the attractive addition to the decor of one's environment, especially in arrangements with contrasting xenoflora and xenofauna. For the fashion conscious, heads are available now in a range of natural tints from brown through pink. When treated with new special formula Fungi X, heads can also be cultivated in more agreeable colors, though fungifying processes will abbreviatedly markedly the lifetime of the heads so treated. Everyone should have his own head, and now everyone can. Thanks to the diminished chest volume of the new improved head, the result of recent advances in biominiaturization, heads are cheaper than before. They eat less and take up less space, too. Why don't you buy your new head today? Any head you buy from XO Export is guaranteed to be the native handicraft of its autochthonous planet, where bioengineering has long been practiced by the wild four-limbed progenitors and manufacturers of the heads. There are 1,000 laughs in store for you in the new improved head. Why don't you buy your new head today? Why don't you buy your new head today? Why don't you buy your new head today? Only $49.95 from XO Export Monopolies. Okay, let me catch my breath for a second. Okay, you know, not too many stumbles. A couple. I think I stumbled worse last night than today. And it's also more fun to be close mic'd so you can, you know, hit words like head. Or if you need to do a quote like, two heads are better than one, as opposed to two heads are, you know, well, radio tricks. Love them. That comes from a short story collection entitled, guess what? Fun with Your New Head. Long out of print, but I'm sure you can find it. Also, Gregory Feely, who was here last night, gave is putting together an anthology of some of the best short stories of Tom Dish, and I have little doubt that that will be amongst them. So now that we got the commercial out of the way, let's set your Wayback Machine 10 years and four, today is the 7th, right? Yes. In New York, it's the 7th. California, it's the 6th. But in New York, 10 years and 4 days ago to July 6th. Sorry, July 3rd. June. I can't read my own. It's 080603, you know, so the year comes first, then the month, then the date, and then the section. Karen Russell was A, Tom Dish was B. June 3rd, 2008, just a little before Tom Dish's untimely but planned for end. Here he is at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, that at the time was held at the South Street Seaport. Welcome back, everybody. The second half of our final reading for what is, I have determined, is Gordon Van Gelder. Wasn't sure when the series started. I've been calling it the 19th season. Gordon said, that's all wrong. I now know, pretty sure, this is the 18th season. And after that particular story, and when you close out a season, what do? You go straight to the source for everything. And I mean the source. Now, for me, I first met Tom Dish in the late 60s at WBAI when I was an intern for the late, great Baird Searles, who was the drama and literature director at that time. At that time, Tom Dish was not yet God. He is now. I had thought that last year when we did a reading with James Morrow, whose stuff is quite heretical, and Charlie Pellegrino, who co-produced on television this thing where he authenticated DNA from a tomb that is purported to be the tomb of the family of Jesus. So I thought that that was our heretical reading. Welcome to tonight. Tom Dish's first novel, The Genocides, appeared in 1965. He soon became known as part of the new wave of science fiction, writing for New Worlds magazine and other avant-garde publications. His critically acclaimed novels... this is copied from Wikipedia, by the way.
Oh.
So let me say, and we have a representative here, so let me say, and I quote, novels of include... Wikipedia needs proofreaders. Okay. Novels of include Camp Concentration and 334, both of which are in the back, by the way, On Wings of Song and... of course, The Brave Little Toaster. In the 80s, he moved from science fiction to horror with a series of books set in Minneapolis, which is horror, yeah, Minneapolis.
The capital.
First, yeah, absolutely. Those include The Businessman, and when The Businessman came out, Tom read for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, when Claire Wolf, I believe, was... the administrator at that point, the MD, the priest, and the sub. In 1999, he won the nonfiction Hugo for The Dreams Our Stuff Is Made Of, A Sardonic Look at the Field, as well as the Michael Brody Award for Light Verse. Among his other nonfiction work, he has written theater and opera criticism for the New York Times, The Nation, and other periodicals. He's also published several volumes of poetry. And let me just say, if you go to his live journal, in 1 week there's more good poetry there than you'll find in a lot of other places. Quite voluminous stuff. With his latest novel, The Word of God, Tom Dish reveals his elevation to godhood. But to retain it, he must do battle with the recently reincarnated Philip K. Dick. And with that, supplicants, I give you Thomas M. Dick.
I should explain that I'm not a monotheist type of God. You're allowed to have other gods before you. And I'm friendly with other gods. There's not that many of us. And, you know, on holidays, who else are you going to have a drink with? So I say that because nowadays, so often, people talk about religious controversy and they're afraid of suicide bombers and things like that. I'll assure you, you know, sort of from the get-go, that I don't require such services from any of you. I rather frown on it as a practice by fellow gods. I think that they can do very well without asking their worshippers to kill themselves. And in fact, how would you run a business if you told all the customers to go kill themselves? I just think it's foolish. And I've told Allah so, but does he listen? No. Anyhow, I thought I would read. There's many instructive parts in this book. The first chapters give you my sense of why I think people need to read religious texts a little more skeptically than they are used to doing. But for that sort of instruction, I'll let you deal with the book yourself. If it were the Quran, you know, you'd have to memorize it. You'd have to set your children rocking back and forth and committing every page to memory. I don't ask that. I think it's in the, I'm quite happy if you read it once through and consider what it says, and then maybe go on and write your own testament, which is what poets do. I consider scriptural writing of this sort a form of poetry, and indeed, here's a poem. That states, it says, the lot of the new God represents my first public proclamation of my divinity, and as such, it's a poem of universal significance. What more can I say except, and then here's the poem, the lot of the new God, the Balad is a French form, rather a strict one too, but here it is. I have decided I'm divine. Caligula and Nero knew a godliness akin to mine, but they are strictly hitherto. They're dead, and what can dead gods do? I'm here and now, I'm dynamite. I'd worship me if I were you. A new religion starts tonight. No booze, no pot, no sex, no swine. I have decreed them all taboo. My words will be your wine, the thought of me your honeydew. You'll call yourself a Thomasite and hymn my praise with loud yahoo. A new religion starts tonight. But you might think, that's asinine. I'm just as much a god as you. You may have built yourself a shrine, but I won't bend my knee. Who asked you to be my god? I do. Who am, as God, divinely right? Now you must join my retinue. A new religion starts tonight. All that I have said is true. I'm God, and you're my acolyte. Surrender's bliss. I envy you. A new religion starts tonight. Anyhow, that's there's some explanation about how Dana Joy, the head of the National Endowment of the Arts, has been known to recite that poem at public readings of his own. So, if that isn't having apostles, what is? Here is what I'm reading tonight. It's chapter 6 of the book, and it's a self-contained story with a two-page preface. As I've already noted earlier, gods are great ones for masquerading. The Holy Ghost descends as a dove. Zeus, on a similar mission, visited the lovely Io in the form of a cloud. Correggio gave a scrumptious account of that close encounter. Even when they're not trying to conceal their divine identities, gods like fancy clothes, if we're to trust the paintings they appear in. I am no different. My favorite form of fancy dress has always been Western wear. At the age of 12, I used to clip out the ads for Levi's jeans from Life and use them for my own devotional purposes. I got a really snazzy cowboy shirt when I was 14, pink and black with fringe and pearl snaps. Whoopee! Though I never dared wear it to school. As for boots and rodeo-sized belt buckles, wide-brimmed Stetsons, those glories had to wait until I had escaped the Twin Cities for New York City, where the deer and the antelope play, and one seldom hears a discouraging word. Discouraging words were rife in Minnesota. I never got to meet any real cowboys until just after age 18, when I was locked up in an army brig with a guy my own age who was really good-looking, played chess at my own earnest, mediocre level, and confided in me how he intended to murder his father the minute he got discharged from the army. I don't remember the guy's name, but I was enthralled to such Dostoevskian pizzazz. I didn't feel an equal reverence for the Mormons. What's that? There's a peculiar typo here, but I don't know. Who were my neighbors in Omeka-Meka 6 years later. But the hunkier one of them competed in rodeos and had the scars to prove it. There was no doubt who was the alpha male in that patio. I'm sure I'm not alone in my conviction that if Jesus had put off his incarnation for 2,000 years or so, as I have, he would have delivered homilies about the good cowboy rather than the good shepherd, and our calendar art would be radically sexier. Stories about lost sheep can as easily concern themselves with cattle. I've worked with cattle myself, though I rode a tractor rather than a horse, and spent more time baling hay than dealing directly with the cows and heifers. Still, it was hands-on experience and should count for something in terms of rooting my worship in the American experience and the myth of the West. As much as I admire Western wear, I don't think I will make it a required component of my worship, like yarmulkes or burkas. Sideburns, chaps, and six-shooters will be optional. The reason I bring them up at all is that they are emblems of a side of the American way of faith that is very much the point of my worship, I hope to inspire myself, and there is no better way to unfold the deeper meaning these emblems embody than to include the following parable from 2 decades ago in the body of my holy writ. So this is that story, and it's called The New Me. Close your eyes now, said Dr. Schenker. It's night, you're tired, and we're not here to discuss reality. Reality's boring and much too painful. We're concerned with your needs. Now, ever so slowly, you're drifting away You're out of control. You're out of control. You're a zombie. How do you feel? Wide awake, I'm afraid, I replied. You think you're wide awake, he said somewhat testily. In fact, you're in deep hypnotic trance. Repeat that. In fact, I'm in a deep hypnotic trance, but it doesn't feel like it. There was never even a spell when I was drowsy. Mr. Gulbradson, you must be more cooperative. It's your job that's at stake. If you don't make the effort that's required of you, you'll be out on the street. The director of personnel left no doubt of that. Now, do you want a new personality or don't you? It's not a question of what I want, really. It's my students. They don't like me. And as a result, it seems, they're unwilling to learn anything from me. Actually, I doubt if my personality has much to do with it one way or the other. They've told themselves in advance they can't understand math, so they don't try. None of them want to be structural steel draftsmen, for which I can't blame them, since there aren't any jobs for them once they're out of the training program. If there were, believe me, I wouldn't be tutoring terminally unemployable dropouts in trigonometry. I'd take the job myself. That's my assessment of the situation. Yet the classes of other teachers consistently score better than yours. How do you account for that? Cynicism on the part of the other teachers. They're not teaching math, just a procedure for thumbing through Smoley's new combined tables. A pigeon could do that with practice. Then show your students as much consideration as you would a pigeon and teach them that procedure. But first, of course, you must make them listen to you. And I gather there has been some resistance on their part to doing so. Little wonder, I should say. You fairly radiate defeat, Mr. Gulbradson. Your suit is the contemporary equivalent of sackcloth and ashes. You walk like a pallbearer. Your smile is 80% sneer. Where is the joy of life? Where is the appetite, aggression, energy? Yes, well, I thought you said we wouldn't discuss reality. I'd like to make a strong post-hypnotic suggestion, Mr. Gulbradson. The company offers an assertiveness training group every Thursday at 6:30 in D conference room. Be there. And sensitivity is on Friday. You might as well go to that, too. What could I do? I didn't want to be fired. I went. I learned the recommended techniques of assertiveness and sensitivity, and I followed all of Mr. Shanker's post-hypnotic suggestions. I changed my name, my clothes, my habits, my opinions. I developed a more sincere smile and a stronger handshake. One Friday night, I went on a marathon crying jag, following which I had a short but intense affair with one of the secretaries I'd impressed by my openness and vulnerability. I taught myself to draw in basic Mr. Mech style like NBC's Marshall Jack. On weekends, I attended rodeos, square dances, and barbecues. As a result of my new behavior patterns, my life changed much along the lines the doctor had predicated. My students paid closer attention, if only, I suppose, for my oddity, and got better exam scores. I formed a new circle of friends, chiefly among other men who dressed in Western apparel. Professionally, they were a varied lot. Two accountants, a dentist, a labor racketeer, and an advertising copywriter. They were also, like me, on the heavy side. Everything seemed to be functioning smoothly, and then I made the mistake of telling Dr. Shanker about my doubts as to the authenticity of this way of life. I suspected that all my new acquaintances were acting as they did because they were in assertiveness training, too. He assured me that what I needed was a lesson in basic trust and self-confidence, and gave me a card that for... that gave me, another typo, a 10% discount at a skydiving school that would teach me these lessons. As an inducement, he promised me that after my first jump, I wouldn't have to take any more therapy. I'd be considered a completed job. 3 weeks later, I was back on his couch in complete objection, a dropout from my jump school. Close your eyes now, the doctor told me. We're going deep, deep into your psychic sub-basement, right to the bottom where your parents' bones are buried. I'll count to three, and then you'll tell me exactly why you chickened out at the moment of truth. All right, one, two, three. I did not chicken out, I repeated. I told y'all what happened. I went up in the plane. I was standing in line with my parachute, and then the man right in front of me jumps out with a big yahoo, just like they taught us, and jumped right out of his parachute, too. That is unfortunate, surely, but it wasn't likely to happen to you. I was not about to take the chance. The people who run that operation were criminally negligent. Do I have to commit suicide in order to show my basic trust to a bunch of murderers? Accent, Dr. Schenker reminded me. My basic cotton-picking trust, how's that? No need to be sarcastic. The fact remains, Tex, you haven't solved your problem. While the people who did make that jump have achieved some real personal growth. I wonder sometimes, Doc, whether my problem is not having basic trust in other people. I mean, maybe people should be alienated some of the time. Maybe some people don't deserve our trust. You're resisting again, said the doctor, and reached under his desk to press a button that broadcast a mild electric shock to my pleasure center. I flinched. Though possibly skydiving is not the right approach in your case. Maybe the right angle for you would be faith. Your Minnesota multiphasic would suggest that you have intensely religious personality structure. I doubt that somehow, Doc. I mean, for one thing, I'm an atheist, like my pappy before me and his pappy before him. Then you've been stifling your natural disposition. I suggest, Tex, that you accept Christ as your personal savior and get born again. He snapped his fingers in my face. All right, wake up. I blinked my eyes. Are we through? He'd like me to pretend that I couldn't remember anything that went on in our sessions. The next Sunday, I drove down Route 17, checking out the prices of the various religious chapels and tabernacles that specialized in the process of rebirth. How are we doing? Six pages, or should we stop? One, okay, we are going over time. Checking out the prices of the various religious chapels and tabernacles. Just in the process.
Okay, Tom stopped shortly after that. There is more recorded, but not more than we can broadcast right now. So, instead, a cut of music, and we will be back in 5 minutes with a reading by Gardner Dozois. This is Dori Previn.
Jesus was a androgyne. Jesus was a he and she. Jesus was a...
And I should mention, this is WBAI, New York.
You and me. Jesus was a...
Jesus was a he and she. Jesus.
give me your androgyne.
Okay, that's, again, I'm afraid, slightly truncated, but it's a long song. And that was the relevant part to Tom Dish's reading. If you don't know the work of Dori Previn, you should find what you can. She is brilliant. And she was a person who had a lot of issues in her life. And she, her name Previn, of course, comes from her marriage to André Previn, the conductor, composer of both classical music and jazz. And part of her troubles, personal troubles, began. She wrote a song called "Beware, Little Girls." Beware of little girls, certain girls. When Mr. Previn allegedly brought a young girl into the, a much younger woman, into their marriage bed while Dori Previn was still there. And that was somebody who had been married, in fact, to Frank Sinatra, and went over to André Previn at that point. And her name was Mia Farrow. And, you know, it only gets more complicated from there. Do I remember my facts correctly? No, I don't. I suggest do the research yourself. But Dori Previn. And as far as Thomas M. Dish is concerned, we're going to have to do more programs. Hopefully I can take the audio. Thankfully, besides the video that we were showing over live stream last night, which you can look up through a link on Facebook from my page, or you can go to live stream itself and look up the name Dish, D-I-S-C-H. There won't be too many. And of course, this occurred on the date of June 5th, so you'll be able to figure out which it is. And again, apologies in advance for the technical issues. There were a great many, but a lot of great stuff also still came through, and we're going to revisit the work of Tom Dish on this program sometime soon. But really, this morning has to be about somebody who was also on this show a few times, yes, about three or four times, and also three or four times was a reader at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And he had been absent for about 10 years for a very different reason, Mr. Dish. He, Gardner Dozois and his wife Susan Casper, were in a horrific, horrific traffic accident where they were passengers in a cab, and neither of them were well after that. Susan died, I guess, about 2 years ago, and Gardner died last week, a little, maybe 10 days ago. And it's a great loss. Gardner Dozois was editor of Asimov Science Fiction magazine till he resigned from that position to go back to writing. And he was with Asimov's, maybe 15 years. You know, I really ought to do my research, right? Before I go on the air, let's just wiki this thing. Wikipedia, da-da-da. Come on. Machines are slow here. English. Okay, and then within there, there's the search. Let's choose Gardner. D-O-Z-O-I-S, Dozois, is how it is pronounced. He died at age 70 years old on May 27th, to be precise. And he was an anthologist working with George R.R. Martin and Jack Dann. He did the Isaac Asimov's anthologies. He was, those anthologies are among my favorites because they would have titles like, oh, unicorns. And then you'd get a whole book of nothing but short stories of unicorns or time gates or things like that. So for me, it was a treasure trove in the days when I was still reading live on the air, which I've stopped doing because in those days the stuff couldn't be copied off the internet and it wasn't a big issue to be broadcasting live at 5 a.m. And most people knew that I did it and I got their permission in general, if not stories. But nowadays it's different. Now I've got to do it more specifically. Oh my God, yes. It was the Magic Tales Anthology series, most under Ace. Oh God, I can't begin to tell you how many. Aliens, unicorns, magic cats, bestiary, mermaids, sorcerers, dog tails, invaders, horses, angels, dinosaurs, two hackers, future crime, beyond singularity, and so forth. And then the Isaac Asimov's series of books that he put out, there are 5, 10, 15, about 25 of those. And there's then the year's best science fiction series, which, oh dear, okay. The first collection came out in 1984, and the most recent one was 2017, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's still one to come. And as a person, Gardner was a treasure. He was a bizarre, wonderful, wacky, delightful person. His closest friend probably was Michael Swanwick, and I'm going to have to talk to Michael about doing something proper as a tribute send-off to Gardner Dozois. But Michael aided that already. Last October, I had the opportunity. I was so anxious to get Gardner back reading somewhere that I did a horrific thing and double-booked that night. We were going to be doing a remembrance of somebody not as famous, Amma Patterson, but every bit to me as significant a human being. And that was going to be done by Cherie Renee Thomas and Andrea Harrison, Pan Morgan. And I bleeping double booked it. I screwed up badly. And while I feel horrible for that, I hope that we will get those people back at some point. I'm very pleased that we were able to get Gardner Dozois there in time. And so we have that recording for you next. Now, this is unedited. I am going to have to listen to it while we are playing it, and you will hear it start and stop and start and stop as I seek the correct point at which to begin. Since the whole thing unedited, if I started it now, we'd be into Lister's show. I better do it, but first let me just say that this is WBAI in New York City, broadcasting now from Four Times Square instead of the Empire State Building at 99.5 FM. We're also over WBAI.org on the internet and occasionally intermittently on Facebook Live, albeit not this morning. So, let's begin this recording. Let's, I suspect, yeah, right there, it's just me. We don't want to hear me. Yeah, we don't need to hear. Oh, yeah, this is rubbish. Good. Because we're already 10 minutes in.
The year's best science fiction, which has won the Locus Award for best anthology more than any other anthology series in history, and which is now up to its 34th
This is good,
collection.
Because this will bring us up to 250, and that's just fine. So let's play it from here on in. However, knowing that this is Gardner, let me just warn you that it's quite possible that this segment of the show may contain frank language. If you are offended by frank language, please tune out now and rejoin us at 3 a.m. for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister coming up. So let's go back now to last October in this very building for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings.
He get into a television, faded away.
Oh, God.
I warned him, but he didn't listen.
Yeah, really? Beauty and the Beast got us.
Talking about his friend George Martin.
Actually, his take on the Twilight Zone was excellent. Nobody remembers that. The second out of the three Twilight Zones, George was the script. What do they call it? Showrunner for the, I think, second and third season. Some guy named Ellison did the first season. In collaboration with George R.R. Martin and Daniel Abraham, Hunter's Run, and in addition to many solo anthologies, including Songs of the Dying Earth, Warriors, Dangerous Women, and Rogues, all co-edited with the aforementioned George R.R. Martin, the last two of which were New York Times bestsellers. Coming up is a major solo fantasy anthology. Hold it up for the camera.
Yay!
The Book of Swords. He has been inducted into the Science Fiction Hall of Fame, which can be very painful, and won the Skylark Award.
They use lubricants.
I thought it was sandpaper.
They use sandpaper.
No. No, for me, they use the abattoir blades. And won the Skylark Award for Lifetime Achievement in Science Fiction. Born in Salem, Massachusetts, having escaped the trials, he now lives in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Everybody, please welcome back Gardner Biswell.
Hi, everybody. As you've heard, I'm Gardner Biswell. I don't know, some guy they dragged in off the street. I was hustling for small change on the corner down there, and they said, "Do you want to read?" And I said, "Yeah, why not?" My career as a writer was pretty much over years ago, but lately, the last two or three months, to my own surprise, I have found stories popping up into my head and sort of oozing out onto the paper in a messy, Icarus, Lovecraftian sort of way. And they're odd little things. I'll read you a couple of them now. This story is called Neanderthals. I hate going up against Neanderthals. They have bigger bones than us, with room for more muscle attachments, which makes them a lot stronger than humans, even stronger than my augmentations make me. They also have fast twitch muscles, which makes their reflexes nearly as quick as my own. Don't believe the old picture of them as lumbering brutes. They move fast and are quite limber and agile. They also have remarkable stamina and a much higher pain threshold than baseline humans, so they're hard to put down. An injury that would have an ordinary human writhing with pain on the floor won't stop them. They'll just keep coming at you. All this makes them good bodyguards, of course. And there were two of them guarding the armored door that led upstairs to the office where Mr. Cirillo ran his clandestine business selling exotic designer drugs manufactured in one of the moon colonies. I got in about as close as I thought I could using the camouflage bubble suit. So I popped it open, and a puff of interior air spilled out. As soon as it did, the bigger Neanderthal's head went up, and I saw his nostrils twitch. They have a better sense of smell than us two, and he'd smelled me. Before they could react further, I stepped out of the suit and brought up the sawed-off. There hadn't been room for anything bigger in the suit, but I'd reinforced it to hold the heaviest rounds it would hold for maximum stopping power. They were just starting to move when I emptied both barrels, first shooting the bigger Neanderthal on the left, then tracking over to shoot his smaller companion. They both dropped. The smaller one was obviously dead, with his chest splayed open in what the old Norsemen used to call the blood eagle. But the big one was already back up on his feet, and I saw that he was wearing a vest of spider silk armor, something unusual for Neanderthals,
who usually didn't rely on technology. The shock and pain of impact alone probably would have been enough to keep a baseline human down for a while, even one wearing a vest. But the Neanderthal seemed unfazed, the bastard, back up and ready for action. He was also grinning broadly at me. I dropped the sawed off and had my hand on the butt of my backup. I could see that he was armed too, with a heavy-duty pistol, but he was making no move to go for it, and something about that jaunty grin made me hesitate for a moment. "Here's the part where you kill me or I kill you," he said in that mellow, singing tenor voice they have, which always comes as a surprise coming out of a hulk like that, who you'd think would have a rumbling, growling bass instead. He winked at me. "And it's not at all certain which way it would go. I have a better idea." To my amazement, he very slowly drew his pistol from its holder, using only two fingers, and tossed it aside. Neanderthals didn't much like guns as a rule, and are not particularly good with them, but I couldn't figure out what his strategy was in disarming himself, and that made me cautious. "Let's kill the old bastard together," he said jovially. "I never liked him anyway, and I've gotten tired of standing in front of this door all day, so we can fucking well consider our killing him to be my resignation." He winked at me again grinning that grin. I know you probably brought explosives to blow the door, but hey, that's a real heavy door, and I know the door code. A few minutes later, we were drinking Irish whiskey together in a rundown bar around the corner. The place was old and shabby, the tables stained and scarred with graffiti and initials, decades obsolete phosphorescence buzzing and flickering dimly overhead, empty except for a shriveled old bartender leaning propped against the wall behind the bar, eyes partially closed, either napping or reviewing all the mistakes he'd made with his life. It was a damp night, and I could hear a clock chiming somewhere, the sound carrying on the dank air, and my augmented hearing also picked up the iron scrape and slither as one of the immense Navy hovercraft pulled its way up out of the polluted water and oil slicks of the harbor and ghosted away across the land. The Neanderthal, he told me his name, but it was 16 or more characters long and all consonants, so I'll continue to call him the Neanderthal, took a sip of his whiskey, swirling it around in his mouth like it was mouthwash, seeming totally at ease. I upped my metabolism to burn away the alcohol. With his huge body mass, there was no way I was going to be able to keep up with his capacity for booze without help. "Don't you care that I killed your friend?" I asked him with genuine curiosity. He shrugged. "Not particularly. We have tribal loyalty, not personal, which is sometimes hard for you guys to understand. I would have fought to the death to protect him, since he was a member of the tribe, but once he was dead, I wasn't particularly upset about it. He wasn't a friend, I don't mourn him, I didn't even like him. He was a tribesman." He flicked his finger, dismissing the matter, took another big swig of his whiskey, and leaned forward with the air of someone getting down to business. "You'll keep all the money for this kill, of course, since it was your job to begin with, but I expect to be paid, and paid well, for the next one. Who are you working for? Mr. Kang's mob? Eastsiders? The Swedes?" I laughed, and for a fleeting moment he looked disconcerted. "You've got it all wrong," I said. "I don't give a shit about Cirillo's drug business, and I don't work for a rival cartel. He had to die because of the people he was connected to, and the people behind them. The Neanderthal looked puzzled, and it was my turn to grin. You see, I'm not a drug enforcer or a mobster. I'm a time traveler. He was frowning at me now. You're nuts. I leaned forward, smiling, as though I was about to import a big secret to him, which I was, in fact, although it wouldn't make any difference. There are two rival groups of us. Call them armies, if you will. Us and them. We don't use fancy names. When we find someone working for the other side, we wipe them out. The other side retaliates, taking out some of our people. The idea is to interfere with whatever operation they have going on, keep them from changing the future in ways we don't like. The Neanderthal snorted derisively. That's bullshit. In fact, it's the plot of an old paperback novel I read when I was still in the crèche. Time travel is impossible. It doesn't exist. If you're feeding me this crap because you heard that tall tale about how they went back with a time machine and brought a bunch of us back to the present, that's crap too. We don't come from the past. We're the result of genetic manipulation, working with remnant DNA in the human bloodstream and breeding for us like they did with the mammoths. Matter of fact, I was whipped up in a crèche not far from here, over by the spaceport. It was my turn to shrug and take a sip of whiskey. Suppressing my automatic reflex of analyzing the components it was made from and concentrating on the taste, which was lousy. You were one of our recent failures, in fact. The other side wanted you for foot soldiers and changed things so that some scientists figured out how to bring you into the world. We tried to negate the change, but there were too many possible paths that led to your discovery, so we couldn't, and the world is stuck with you. As for that book and a bunch of other old novels like it, some of us were worried about that, but we decided to ignore them. Nobody listens to writers anyway. The Neanderthal was looking at me thoughtfully, as though he might be beginning to believe me. If all this is true, he said, sounds like your side is losing. I repressed a surge of anger, smoothing out my endocrine balance. Sometimes it seems like that to me, too. It seesaws back and forth, one side getting the advantage, then the other one. We'll see what we come up with to counter the advantage all you fucking Neanderthals has given them. Since you're all working for them, one way or another, whether you realize it or not. I put my glass down, and even with limited artificial control over my limbic system, I couldn't entirely keep the anger out of my voice. We don't have your kind of tribal loyalty as humans, even augmented, enhanced cyborgs from the future. Well, we do, I guess. But personal loyalty is more important to most of us. After you assholes popped into the timeline, I was on a mission and one of you killed someone very important to me, someone I loved. I took a quick slug of whiskey. So I hate all you fucking monsters. And since then I've made it a point to kill as many of you as I can, whether I'm on a mission or not, whether that's what they want me to do or not. The Neanderthal looked at me. So I take it then, he said mildly, that we're not going to be working together. He was starting to slur his words, a symptom at long last. No, not by any means, I said. I already killed you. Upstairs, when we shook hands over the body of your big boss, there's a patch on the underside of one of my fingers that enables me to use DSMO to pump poison into your bloodstream. I shook my head. I'm amazed, by the way, truly amazed and truly impressed that you're not dead yet. I pumped enough into you to kill four men, and here you still sit a half hour later drinking whiskey. He started to do something fast and tricky, half rising from his chair, but his muscles failed him, and he slumped back down again. I moved my own chair back a couple of feet, the scraping noise making the bartender look up for a second before he too slumped back into his former position. The Neanderthal could still do a lot of damage to me if he could get his hands on me, and now he knew he had nothing left to lose, but I wasn't going to let that happen. The Neanderthal was still staring at me, and I was having difficulty reading his expression. Sadness? Disappointment? If there was fear there, I couldn't see it. I was pumped with an adrenaline surge myself, and I did my best to keep emotion out of my voice when I spoke, remembering that old saying about revenge being a dish best served cold. Let him think that this meant nothing more to me than stepping on a cockroach. You don't belong here, I said, speaking calmly and rationally. We hunted you to extinction during the last ice age and will hunt you to extinction again. For all your brawn, we're better than you, smarter than you, more adaptable. We wiped you out once, we'll wipe you out again. The Neanderthal actually laughed. A lot of scientists no longer think that's what happened, he said, a quizzical expression on his big, broad face. But it doesn't matter one way or the other. We survived in your bloodstream. He jabbed a blunt finger toward me. We're in there now, still. You are us, and we are you. We'll never be rid of each other. He fumbled for his glass to take another drink, one for the road, perhaps, in the ultimate sense. But his fingers were clumsy now, and he knocked it over, the liquid spreading slowly out across the wooden tabletop. Suppress us now, he said sadly. Kill all of us. It won't matter. We're hiding in your bloodstream, and we'll only come out again someday. His smugness infuriated me in spite of limbic control, and I was tempted to shoot him, splatter that bland face, but there was no point. He was already dead. Before I could say anything in response to refute him, he jerked, as if someone had cut all of his strings at once, and crashed forward, his head thunking solidly into the tabletop, splashing the spreading pool of whiskey. The noise had woken the bartender up again, and he blinked at me with gummy eyes. A bit too much to drink, I said to him as I rose. He'll be all right. I walked down a corridor in the back of the bar towards the toilets. Then I whistled up a wall, walked through it, and was gone. I think I've got time to read another one. Most of these are very short. This one is called Watchmen. The first thing the dead man noticed was light beating against his closed eyelids. He opened his eyes, squeezed them shut again against the painful dazzle, and lay still, feeling his heart beating again, breath rasping again in his throat, and the cold texture of the stone he was resting on, trying to coax memory to flow back. Wisps of memory did slowly trickle back, but there were huge gaps. He dimly realized that he had been through all of this before, many times, but how and where and why the cycle began was lost in the mists of time. He couldn't remember his name. He had had so many names, stretching endlessly back and back until the memory of who or what he'd originally been was forgotten. Sometimes, he remembered, on waking, he had tried to fool himself into thinking that he'd only been asleep. But no, he'd been dead. There was just darkness, no afterlife, no dreams, no awareness of self, non-existence, until he quickened into life again to find that years or decades had passed. Hands were fumbling at him, trying to get him to sit up. After a couple of false starts, his muscles screaming with pain from long disuse, he managed it. He opened his eyes and this time forced himself to keep them open. He was in a crypt, well, resting on a marble slab. The crypt door had been opened, and intense sunlight was streaming in, almost too bright to look at, dust motes dancing in the beam. There were two others in the crypt with him, standing by the edge of his bier, an old man and an awestruck boy of about 12. Squinting at them, cudgeling his memory, he finally realized that the old man had been the nervous, wide-eyed boy accompanying a different old man the last time he'd awoken. By the next time, the boy would be the leathery old man, accompanied by some boy who might not even have been born yet. He couldn't remember what the old man's name was, but it didn't seem to matter. After all, he couldn't remember his own name. Standing was an effort, but swaying and groaning, he managed to stay on his feet. Wordlessly, the old man and the boy helped him to dress in a fresh set of clothes, the frightened boy trying to avoid touching him as much as possible. He was very weak and had to lean on the old man's bony shoulder as they stumbled out of the crypt. Outside, a cool breeze helped to revive him a little, and he stood for a moment drinking in the world, the curve of the blue river that ran at the foot of the cemetery, the puffy white and gray clouds overhead, the wildflowers that had sprung up here and there among the graves, providing bursts of purple and yellow and red. Then they stumbled up the hill to the road that bisected the cemetery, where a battered old car, one side window broken and taped over, the rear seat split open and oozing stuffing, waited for them. He was still weak and shaky, and everything looked like it was being viewed through the wrong end of a telescope, as though there was a layer of muslin or cheesecloth between him and reality. And as he climbed into the car, he realized that, as always upon awakening, he was very, very hungry. Without needing to be told, after all, he'd been through this with him once before as a young boy himself, the old man drove them up to the road that ran along the top of the ridge, where there was a small working-class diner. He managed to climb the steps leading up from the street with the help of the old man and the reluctant boy, although he felt a brief stab of shame at the weakness he was displaying before the other customers, who looked up at him for a moment as he passed by down the central aisle, then went back to their meals. Once seated at a booth with a formica-topped table, red cushioned bench seats, and an ancient wall jukebox that no longer worked, he ordered in a voice that came out as a hoarse, barely audible rasp, and he realized that he hadn't heard himself speak for a very long time. When the food came, he worked his way through three double-decker cheeseburgers, two milkshakes, a huge slab of apple pie with vanilla ice cream, and cup after cup of strong black coffee, while the grim-faced old man, who had ordered nothing, watched wordlessly. The boy had reflectively ordered a milkshake, but hadn't touched it, and it sat on the table in front of him while the ice cream melted and a moisture ring formed on the tabletop, and he shrank into the corner of the booth as far as it was physically possible to go. "Don't worry, boy," he said, his voice less rasping now. "I'm not a zombie. I'm alive." But the boy didn't answer, staring at him with the whites of his eyes showing, like a frightened horse. Now that he'd eaten, he could feel the strength flowing back into him. When he walked to the bathroom, between the arrival of the burgers and the pie, the springing vigor was back in his step, and the layer of muslin was gone from his vision. When he pissed, It felt as if the last remnants of non-existence and unreality were being flushed from his body and washed away down the drain. He was ready to do what he had to do. They left the diner, the other customers staring at him openly now, either amazed at the huge meal he consumed or puzzled that he no longer needed to be half-carried by someone else in order to walk. They walked a block over cracked pavement with weeds protruding through it to where the car was parked. As they reached the car, he stopped with one hand on the door, looking around him, breathing the cool air deeply into his lungs. In spite of the resolve he'd felt only a few minutes before, a flood of doubts and uncertainty filled him. Every time he did this, out in the world once again, feeling the wind in his hair, seeing the sky, hearing the birds sing in nearby trees, it became harder and harder to do what he was supposed to do. What if one day he didn't? What if he just turned and fled, disappeared under the crowd, never came back, started a new life? But that would be to fail in his duty. Could he live with the shame of that? Do we have to go right away? He asked hesitantly, instantly feeling abashed for having asked. Can we walk down by the river for a while, watch the birds? The old man stared at him, his face unyielding and grim. The dragon must not be allowed to come into the world, he said, and the time is now. He hesitated for another long moment and then sighed and climbed into the car. The old man got behind the wheel next to him while the boy cowered in the back seat. They drove west, across a narrow bridge over the river, then through a series of progressively deteriorating neighborhoods until they reached a block of trash-filled streets and sagging wooden houses, half of them with boarded-up windows and doors, where stone-faced old white men watched them expressionlessly from where they stood around a trash barrel fire. The old man pulled over to park by the curb in front of a dilapidated four-story house from which the paint had almost entirely peeled, and one of the first-floor window shutters hung swinging back and forth in the wind. 304, the old man said. First door in the back. First floor in the back. Then he reached into his pocket and produced a long, heavy-bladed knife, which he proffered handle first. You know where he lives, the dead man said in a flash of sudden anger. Why don't you do it? It must be you, the old man said, calmly but implacably. Reluctantly, he took the knife. A shock went through him as he grasped it. The hilt was cold as ice, so cold it seemed to suck the heat out of his flesh and burn his palm. He got out of the car and walked through the overgrown lawn, almost knee-deep in uncut grass and weeds, to the house. A mangy, half-starved dog stood and yapped at him until he got too close, then turned and fled. He climbed a short flight of stained marble steps, found that the front door was unlocked, and went inside. Up the rickety stairs the dead man went, around and around. It was dark inside the house, and the air was full of dust. The place smelled of ancient piss and boiling cabbage, and some sharp foreign spice he couldn't identify. A baby was crying somewhere. Somewhere further away, a radio was making stretching noises like an insect, so faint that you couldn't tell what music it was playing. A sudden smell of cigarette smoke, which reached him for a moment and then was gone. The third floor. He found number 304, hesitated, shifted his grip on the hilt of the knife, then opened the door and went in. It was a dingy railroad apartment, kitchen in the front, bedroom in the back. The dragon had been frying a pan of eggs and sliced potatoes over the burner of an ancient gas stove and was stirring a bottle of hot sauce into them as he entered. The dragon turned to look at him, still holding a long wooden spoon in one hand. He was a very old man, balding, stoop-shouldered, and pot-bellied, wearing worn jeans and a dirty t-shirt, a cigarette dangling from his lower lip, almost burned down to the filter, leaving a long cone of ashes, balanced precariously at the end. He said nothing, but his eyes took in the knife and he frowned. The dead man walked across the room toward the dragon, keeping the knife pointed out in front of him so that it cut through the waves of pressure he felt battering against him, trying to drive him back. He battled forward until he was a step or two from the dragon, close enough to smell his sour, unwashed reek. At the last moment, the dragon's eyes blazed red, seeming to fill with fire, the dragon rising. He plunged the knife into the dragon's chest, feeling the jolt of the impact from his head all the way to his toes. A shock raced through him, harsh and powerful, as if he'd stuck a fork into an electrical outlet. Almost, he let go of the knife hilt. Almost, but not quite. Instead, he took another step forward and threw his weight against it, grinding it deeper into the dragon's chest. The knife hilt blazed with searing heat in his hand, and he could feel the strength and power pour out of him and into the dragon, surrounding the dragon's own power, tamping it down and down, smothering it until it turned into a hot ember and then disappeared. It wasn't the weapon that killed the dragon as much as it was the giving up of his own life in the process. The knife was only the conduit between them. The dragon hissed at him and then fell against him so that he could smell the garlic and decay on his breath as he panted against his face inches away. The dragon dropped the wooden spoon, which hit the tile floor and clattered away. The dragon clawed ineffectually at him for a moment and then collapsed, seeming to shrivel as he fell, until he resembled nothing so much as the long cone of ashes that had been dangling from his cigarette. He stood there numbly for a moment, already feeling the remains of his strength beginning to fail. There was a sharp new smell in the panoply of kitchen odors. The dragon had pissed himself as he died, and a yellow pool of urine was spreading out across the tile. The dead man stepped over it, paused for a second to turn off the burner on the gas stove. No sense killing all the other poor bastards who had to live here, and then left the apartment. Somehow, he made it back down the stairs, although he was weakening with every step and almost fell once. Outside, away from the thick, smothering stinks of the hallway and into the open air, he made it most of the way back across the overgrown lawn before sinking to his knees. The old man and the boy rushed up, got him to his feet, and bundled him into the back seat of the car, the boy crawling in with him. The old man gunned the engine, and they pulled away from the curb, past the grim-faced men who were still standing motionless around the trash barrel fire, as if they'd long ago learned the futility of going anywhere at all. He lay in the back seat with his head resting on the boy's lap, watching the tops of trees and the upper floors of houses speed by outside. The boy looked concerned rather than frightened now and kept patting him on the arm in a reassuring way, an attempt at comforting that they both knew was futile. He could feel the cold and numbness slowly creeping up his arms and legs. His mind began to drift, and he struggled to stay alive a little while longer. Were there others like him, he wondered, going through the same cycle, fighting different dragons? Surely there must be, as he'd never awakened in any crypt anywhere else, as far as he could remember. And surely there must be dragons being born into the world in other places than this. Or were the dragons somehow constrained by his presence here to try to enter the world only where he himself was? Were their fates tied together by some cosmic destiny? He only waking at the same time as a dragon was attempting to rise, if it only able to rise in the location where he waited in his crypt, a dance that might have gone on for hundreds or even thousands of years? Or, and he remembered having this uneasy thought before, was all of this a delusion? Were there really any dragons, or had he just murdered a helpless old man, as he had murdered countless others before, because he had been manipulated into doing so for some sinister occult reason that he didn't understand? He was finding it hard to breathe now, and his vision was dimming. He'd lost his peripheral vision, a slice of the world reaching him only through surrounding cones of darkness, and the darkness was closing in as the cones narrowed. When he closed his eyes this time, would he open them again upon another day? Or was this the last time, and there'd be nothing from here until the end of time except darkness and non-existence and unknowing oblivion? He didn't know. He didn't even know which outcome he wished for. He closed his eyes. Yeah, well, I could, you know, I could go on.
We could go on all night, yeah. And there are many of us who wouldn't mind if he did, but it's also near, oh, it's exactly 9 p.m.
Yeah, so that being 9 p.m. on October 3rd of last year, which on the one hand saying, you know, October 3rd of last year sounds like so long ago, and yet at the same time, it was near the beginning of our season for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. It was the second one of the year. And we just did our last one of the year last night. Now, we're going to have a summer series, so we're not even skipping a month. We're going to have, oh God, Seth Dickinson and David Mack will be our readers on July 3rd. Yes, I know that's too close to July 4th, but if we waited until, the next week following that is ReaderCon, and I'm going away for ReaderCon. I wouldn't be here to do it. And by the way, Lister, Ken Gale will be filling in for me that week. So you'll have a fun segue with him. And, you know, no sooner do I send him an email saying, can you do this? He tells me who the guests are going to be. And it's all these, you know, wonderful people from the comic book industry. So, although I'm still the one at Chris Claremont on the other day. At any rate, that was 3 weeks ago. Pretty cool. I've got to ask him, but he doesn't know any better than I am. What the bleep is going on with the TV series Legion? Now, I think that may be in some ways one of the best shows ever, and it's based on Chris's writing, as so much in Marvel is. He once said that the only, in Guardians, not Guardians of the Galaxy, in Infinity War, you know, this big, overblown, huge Marvel movie, the only characters from which he did not write episodes for or help flesh out their personalities were the characters from Black Panther. That's one out of about 60 comic books. X-Men and all that, TV series Legion, The Gifted, 13 X-Men movies and all this. All based on stories by Chris, but only Legion gives him credit. Now, I thought the first season of Legion was some of the best television I have ever seen. And now we just saw the penultimate episode of season two. The last episode for the season will be next Tuesday. It has been renewed for a third season. And it darn well better be, because I have no idea what the bleep is going on there. It's entertaining. It's fun. They had one episode this year that is some of the best TV I had ever seen, where after our lead character's sister has been killed, he goes through every alternate universe that he can, and he's capable of changing reality. So he goes and explores all these different universes to find one in which he can be happy, where because his sister had died, and he ends up in the universe that the TV series takes place. We don't know what universe he may have been in before that. This was like deep thinking, brilliant thinking, and the video work they do with the acknowledgments to Stanley Kubrick and David Lynch, and visually and musically, using a lot of Pink Floyd, but also using songs that I thought only I knew. I mean, really obscure stuff. But what the hell is going on with that show? If you have an idea, write me, because we're about out of time. Write me, jim@ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF. Or you can find me on Facebook and regale me there. We have 2 minutes left, so I dasn't take phone calls at this point. What do we have on this show for the rest of the month, now that we are approaching the end, hallelujah, of our fundraising drive? I don't know. I can tell you that Robert Levy will be on near the end of the month. Actually, probably the first week in August, since I will be at ReaderCon in mid-July. I have a tendency to, A, record a lot of interviews at ReaderCon, and B, book a lot of people there, which is how I ended up double booking last October, which I am, on the one hand, so sorry for, but on the other hand, you just heard what happened in its place last October, and we were able to get Gardner Dozois on, and as I said earlier, Gardner died about a week and a half ago, and had it not been for my booking him then, double booking, making that mistake, we would not have been able to hear the recording that you just did. And before that on the program, we heard a reading by Thomas M. Dish from his book, The Word of God. And Tom died 10 years ago, less 1 month. He read for us at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings 10 years and 4 days ago. Arranged to be on the show, like on July 6th, knowing full well that on July 4th, how does one put this subtly? There is no way. On July 4th, he blew his brains out. So he arranged for an interview, like his 20th time on the show or something like that, knowing full well that I would be trying to reach him and, well, he wouldn't be in condition to answer the phone. Yuck. But Tom is very special. Tom was a brilliant writer and brave, brilliant human being, one of the first people I met here at WBAI in 1967-68. And Gardner was a fairly regular guest in this program and somebody who, I got stuck in an elevator with once for about 5 hours at a convention in Pittsburgh. I mean, when you're in fandom, these things happen. We will be hearing more about Thomas M. Dish and about Gardner Dozois in weeks to come. months to come as well. And with any luck, years. But who knows? This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. Everybody, be good to each other because we all deserve it, and you deserve being treated that way as well. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn with Clapper. Burn Baby Burn Clappers coming your way with Lister. That's what I meant to say. Yeah, that's a ticket. Coming up in just a couple of moments. And you can look me up on Facebook, Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D, or there's an Hour of the Wolf group that you're most welcome to join. And stuff like that there. Have a good morning. Take good care. Talk to you next week.
Flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes, 'cause the real meaning is what the message must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru. Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea. Beirut, can't forget Haiti. Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia. Mexico, talking about uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, east and south, central LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Land the free, boom, this is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I toss you the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
Too long, even if it's empty, your sisters, yeah. See, I'm struggling, we are fight worldwide. Only the power of love make humanity survive. God praises me to Rastafari.
He grant us wisdom, love and understanding. May the kindness and compassion in it flow. Cause when your love is pouring out, I know the pagans going down. Your love pouring out, Rastafari.
And I will supply all you need, burning all the envy and greed.
Yeah, no.
Oh, the words of Rastafari could never deceive. Oh, this is that you know. Don't despise the poor. Respect yourself for sure. And God will open all the doors, and you will set the scores. And to me, don't despise the poor. Respect yourself for sure. And God will open all the doors.
The food out of the plate and go empty them. Fresh up the woman, them woman prison plenty men. Then you give them the gallas and say empty them. Then you set that independent and say pen for them. Then you teach them to borrow and say lend for them. How they work them on the money and you want spend for them. That's why me have to lead and set the trend for them. That's why they quote them and go send to them.
Every week, and don't despise the poor. Respect yourself for sure. And I was open all the doors, we set the scores. Help me, and don't despise the poor. Respect yourself for sure. And I was open all the doors.
Am I independent, self-employed?
Se fueron por la fácil y los vi caer. Si vas a arriesgarte, no te dejes ver. La calle no perdona, empieza a correr. El diablo está esperando, ¿qué vas a escoger?
I choose music, my homies chose, yeah. Some of my boys chose the NBA. Cause who's on the block, man, they gang bang. Funeral pilots making all the change.
Yeah, when my cousin got his first tech, I was playing Jimi Hendrix in the basement.
Con la música me quiero ir a girar. Ellos de la blanca quieren facturar. El double,
all he wanted to do was be El Chapo.
Yeah.
99 Sink, list alive, burn, baby, burn. Until 5 o'clock, we burn the imperious red, white, and blue to ashes, yeah. Burn, baby, burn. Snappers. 10 minutes after 3 o'clock.
Salgo por tela madrina, en mi cabeza la mina, efectiva como escopo la mina. Pude desviarme, pero preferí escenarios, estudios y bambalina. Él me cuida, los santos me cuidan, los míos me cuidan. A mi fan, los kilos de music que pidan. Hola, gloria es pa'l campo mayor.
Yeah, television, man, I'm watching and using it. Look like another body in the loo, and he up in the suit with his tie and his shoes. And he laying like he in a Kennedy coat. Banana clip, them, I come from the zoo where the guerrilla military do the coup. Hey, Farina, I told you they coming for me, but the piano was the closest, they got the keys. Yeah. When my cousin got his first tech, I was playing Jimi Hendrix in the basement.